Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness. This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it, so what?
The police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
Recognition of Guaido.
Unelected gobshite.
Is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and so I would reprimand you over that.
Allô, 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 bonjour à tous, bienvenue à IFRC Travel avec Eurodéputé Wallace et Daly.
Bonjour, non.
Hello, hello, hello.
Unfortunately, we don't have six languages like Damien. You know? I mean, I worry about that chap sometimes.
I know, my mission is to get them learning languages, so you're on the Italian and Claire's on the Italian. That's it, right? No other languages that I'm not aware of?
Well, if we're doing another one, it'll be Irish.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'd.
I'm doing all right, yeah.
It's funny, but when it comes to languages, right, yeah, an awful lot depends on your teacher in school.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially in secondary school. Yeah. And my teacher, I didn't get on well with my teacher in secondary school. He didn't like me and I didn't like him. And
I wonder why.
Oh, I'm not sure. It put me off Irish big time, even though I kind of like it.
Yeah.
But I ended up not doing well in Irish. I did honours for the leaving, but I wasn't good at it. And obviously, I'm worse at it now. But I would like to learn it now.
Yeah.
Now that we're out here,
yeah,
I'd be proud to be able to speak it. I would.
Yeah.
And I would like to learn a bit.
Well, yeah, it's a huge privilege. I mean, we see it. It's recognised as a EU language. It's probably the least used of all of them, which is embarrassing. But when you see like 10 million Catalans, the language isn't recognised, and how much it means to them. They can't even speak the language in their own parliament. You know, it really is a shame the way it's taught in Ireland. But look, to start with ourselves, and there's nothing new in that, I suppose.
Yeah, that's certainly a topic for another podcast at some stage about the role of Irish in the European Parliament and in the EU. Currently, there's a derogation on Irish. It can't be used in the committees, but it can be used in the plenaries. We can go into that in some detail at some stage. Very interesting stuff. But this week is a plenary week. All the MEPs are voting away and debating in the big chamber. And I think foreign affairs has really dominated this week. We mentioned in the last episode that we were going to have a debate on Ethiopia and also a debate and resolution on Yemen, which were both requests from yourselves. So happy enough that got on the agenda. Do you want to tell us about the week in foreign affairs?
Well, we were just saying that it's funny, but the plenary is very much... I think foreign affairs kind of dominates the plenary a lot. But which obviously is nice for us because we're very much involved in it, being on the Foreign Affairs Committee and Security and Defence. So, and we're very, very interested in all of it, and we feel that every aspect of it has an impact for every citizen in Europe. And sometimes people in Ireland might think, well, that's really got nothing to do with us, but actually it has. Everything is connected. Just the same as how we abuse small farmers in the global south, not talk about in the global north, is of significance to everybody in Ireland.
But what do you make of the role of the EU having a role even in foreign affairs? It's not a country, it's not a state in any way, it's really just an international organisation of countries cooperating. But why does it have such a big foreign affairs role then?
Well, okay, because first of all, okay, just take something like there's a mad anti-Russian rant going at the moment. There's an anti-Chinese rant going in the EU. And you'll say, well, what's that all about? Well, part of it is to promote the arms industry. I would say that the most powerful lobbyists in Brussels today are the arms industry. People might be shocked to hear that. I mean, we've mentioned the figures before, But in 2020, last year, member states alone spent over 200 billion on defence, on arms, right? Now, we're not at war with anybody, right? But we create a bad Russia and a bad China as if they were going to attack us tomorrow night. And this is used to justify spending billions and billions more on arms, which is absolutely crazy. And we oppose that big time. We have a housing crisis across Europe. Our health system is underfunded in general, especially since the banking crisis in 08, 09, when there was a lot of cutbacks to the health service, even in countries, not just in Ireland, but even in countries like France and Italy and Spain, who really felt the brunt of it with the challenges of COVID. So, I mean, we're spending more and more money on arms. The EU, you're saying, is not a country, right? First of all, it is an institution that has elements of control over 27 member states. It pushes member states to spend more on arms all the time. They'd like them all to spend a minimum of 2% of their GDP on arms. That's one pressure, and that comes from the Commission and the Council and from the Parliament as well, unfortunately. But on top of that, what's new, as you know, the multi-financial framework is just going through the process at the moment for the next 7 years. And for the first time ever, the EU is going to spend billions directly themselves on arms. And it would spend it on, for example, even the Sahel, which is sub-Saharan Africa. And you'll say, well, what in God's name are we doing down there? Well, I'll tell you what we're doing there, right? We're facilitating the facilitating access for member states for minerals at a very cheap price. And sometimes they barely pay for them at all. They have a huge hand in selecting the governments in these places. We then give out about the fact that the governments are all corrupt, but we forget to mention the fact that the people that are actually corrupting them and bribing them, and listen, they are corrupt, but the people bribing them are large corporations from the US, Canada, Russia, Europeans, the Chinese are down there. How much bribing the Chinese do, I'm not so sure. They probably do it in a different way. But we have countries, powerful nations, exploiting these areas for financial gain for their large corporations so that the developed countries, like in the EU, can keep up the lovely lifestyle they've accustomed to. And it's one of the reasons that 4.5 billion people in the global south live in poverty and live on less than $5 a day. So our interest, having a foreign affairs portfolio, it's actually very significant to them all.
Yeah, I mean, the appointment or the coming into being of a high representative of the European Union, I think came out of the Lisbon Treaty, where he's now, he or she, so he at the moment is the vice president of the Commission. And it was a step towards further European integration. The idea of trying to have a unified foreign policy for the EU, which, as Mick said, is really about preserving the world for their markets, to try and have a unified market to exploit and to be a player on the world stage. But I think the contradictions in that goal, you know, it has a limit, and that limit was exposed this week when the current High Representative got into serious hot water, where all the MEPs were up in arms over the fact that he had gone on a visit to Russia, which is actually his job. He's a diplomat. That's his job. He's supposed to be visiting countries. We don't just visit countries that you like. You visit countries that you have problems with, that you might want to do business with. But of course, we should be talking to everybody, particularly ones that are bordering. But it was an example of, I suppose, the growing Russophobia, which has seized the European Parliament and European institutions probably only over the last 4 or 5 years, since Bush's time, or Trump's time, really. That's when it's begun. And it's absolutely relentless. It's now taken on arms and legs, where the overwhelming majority of the European Parliament are obsessed with Russia. You would think that the Red Army is assembling on the borders of Lithuania now, coming in to take their firstborn and the whole lot. It's so irrational. It's absolutely ludicrous. You know, we had a discussion this morning where they were basically saying that Lukashenko in Belarus, which is, you know, would be seen to be pro-Russian, is they put forward a narrative almost that he was kind of developing a nuclear plant just to kind of annoy his own people and possibly exterminate them or something. Like, it's just la-la stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And they were talking about the fact that the nuclear plant was only going to be 50 kilometres away from Lithuania. And, of course, Lithuania would be one of the countries that the members from Lithuania and Estonia and Latvia and Poland, probably, they'd probably be the four probably most violently anti-Russian in here. But, I mean, you would think that the nuclear plant was being put there just so that they can, you know, exterminate the Lithuanians as well. But as an actual fact, I mean, Claire made a very strong point that, listen, we're actually against nuclear plants everywhere.
Yeah.
We're against them in Belarus and in France and wherever, right? Because we disagree with them and we think they're just too dangerous and it's not good for us.
Mm. I'm sure the uranium comes from the Sahel, which is protected by
and
the PESCO
and
money.
Just and I mean, to shortly, to quickly follow up on that point, but if the French couldn't get uranium for peanuts from the Sahel, the French living standard would fall, because French energy, for example, electricity, 75% of it comes from nuclear and all the uranium comes from the Sahel. Mm. So if they had to start paying a proper price for that, price of electricity go through the roof in France.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have a question for you then on foreign affairs. So there has been, as you're saying, Claire, a development in the role of the European Union on foreign affairs. And we have this high representative who's basically a foreign affairs minister, you could think of, for the European Union. But the Parliament has a different role. Do you think it's a bit of a talking shop when it comes to these things? Like, we had a week now of talking about Uganda, Rwanda, Ukraine, Russia, Yemen. We're talking about loads of things, but can it actually do something on foreign affairs, or is it there more to hold Borrell to account, or what's the role of the Parliament in all this?
Yeah. Well, it is a bit of a talk shop, and obviously, I mean, we've explained to the people before, there's three institutions here. We have the Parliament, we have the Commission, and we have the Council. And in terms of foreign affairs, most of the big decisions are made at Council. But at the same time, you would like to think that that the Parliament could have a good influence on the Council about how they behave. But yet, at the same time, I made the point there a couple of weeks ago that the Europeans signed a big deal with a trade deal with the Chinese. It was around protecting investors on both sides, right? And Biden's administration, which still hadn't come into office, begged the Europeans, "Oh, hold on. We need to deal with these Chinese together, because Biden is seriously anti-Chinese, and he campaigned on that ticket. He said that Trump was far too soft on them." But the deal went ahead, and if you were to take a vote in the Parliament, should the deal have gone ahead, right, it would have been an overwhelming no. But in actual fact, business is business, right? And the people, the country that was driving the deal more than anyone else were the Germans. Mm. China is Germany's biggest trading partner. And they're actually going to be bigger in the future, right? And it's where their bread is buttered, right? And I actually think, given that we already have all these trade deals with them, this one, I actually thought that they were dead right to go ahead with it.
Yeah.
And the idea that we'd start a trade war now with China, to me, is rubbish. But in terms of the influence of the Parliament, all the anti-Chinese rhetoric that was going on here about Hong Kong in particular, and the Uyghurs as well, there was mad anti-Chinese rhetoric.
Mm.
But when it came to business, they sat down, done their deal.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they had coffee and scones together and all had a good laugh.
I don't think it's a talking shop, and I don't think it's nothing, you know. And actually, the talk can have an impact, and we kind of saw that in a bit of a negative way this week. I mean, Borrell, is it there to hold him to account? No. I would say he couldn't care less what the European Parliament said. I'd say he went into the session going, "Oh, for God's sake, 30 of there or 80 of these Muppets have signed a letter saying I should resign. I'm getting bad press in the news about this," because there was a press conference during his visit where he was supposedly humiliated by the Russians, and it was an affront to all of our dignity. And the Russian minister pointed out correctly, in my opinion, that who did Borrell think he was giving out about Navalny being incarcerated in and Russia when in Europe there were, you know, Catalan representatives and parliamentarians in prison in Spain. Fair point, I would have thought. So this idea of the European Union going bringing human rights to the world is a nonsense. But you could see by the groundswell of opposition to that visit and the vitriol against Russia, it did have an effect. Now, not just on its own, because that was coming from inside. In that Borrell then went and basically came out of it and said, yes, he would go to the council and support a call for sanctions on Russia. And I'm going, sanctions for what? Like, what have they done? He was criticised for praising the Sputnik vaccine. Hmm. What's wrong with that? I mean, he didn't say, oh, this is the best vaccine. And he kind of said, well done, lads. You have a vaccine that seems to work. How could anybody object to that? Like, it's pathetic. But that was one of the reasons why he was criticised as well. Seemingly, he gave Sputnik, the vaccine, a leg up. And, well, to be frank, I think he should be advocating that the EU goes out of its way to do business with the Russians, with the Chinese, with the Cubans, with the Americans, with everybody to coalesce around vaccine production. So it's a bit mad. So if you like, the talking had an impact. Yeah. It changed a little bit of the narrative. And on the slightly positive side, I was able to get a chance to speak on that topic and I just lashed them out of it for the hypocrisy. And that had a huge impact. I mean, it's all over the news in Russia and all of that. And on the positive side, you can be a bit of a beacon of hope. So it's not nothing by being in here. Like, there was, and interestingly, there was about two or three Irish people who live in Russia who were onto me, who were saying that they've really noticed the sharp rise in Russophobia, that even when they go home to Ireland, people kind of have this narrative about Russia being full of kind of dictators and repression and no freedom, which is completely not the way it is for them. And yeah, they were kind of saying, look, thanks a million for telling it as it is. And the idea that, you know, Navalny is some hero. I mean, the other side of it is I think the EU have some neck. Like, they obviously think that Navalny is finally the one who's going to oust Putin. Now, whether he is or he isn't, or whether he should or he shouldn't, I don't care. It's not my business. That's a matter for the people of Russia. And the idea of the EU butting in is nothing short of scandalous. When we've so many people in jails in our own country, including parliamentarians, and we're going in lecturing other people about it.
Yeah, this is really a case in point, I think, this Russia, whatever happened this week. So Borrell goes to Russia. He says quite honestly, I'll do what I can about Navalny. He doesn't say, I'm going to go there and bring him back or something like you'd expect, which is what we were saying in our resolutions recently on Navalny, the European Parliament. So he goes there. He obviously doesn't come back with holding Navalny's hand, getting off a plane, because how could he? And he actually just went honestly and did what he's supposed to do as a diplomat, meet your neighbours, talk about these transnational and transborder issues. There was a lot of manufactured kind of crisis or like shame or this kind of, like you were saying about the press conference, this, like, it's a lot really made up stuff, really, about this big failure of him going over. Like, it's literally just a trip to Russia to talk about a few things. And it's then this letter is written by all these right wing MEPs asking for him to resign because of this. So that's the context. And Claire, you were the only one in the whole debate on that. Like, people need to know this. Everyone else was saying, ramp it up with Russia, slap on more sanctions. This is a disgrace. They're not treating us with respect. You're the only one saying, let's actually.
Well, there was
dialogue.
A few. There were two or three, like, maybe as well. But yeah, I mean, you're totally right. It was totally one-sided. And you know what I thought
scary,
was
scary, like,
really horrific was, and I said it to Mick, because Mick didn't get speaking time on that. He got it on Yemen, which was the second debate. And, you know, we deal with that now and the horror of the famine and what's gone on the war in Yemen for years. There was person after person after person in the EPP, the group that Fine Gael are in, on Russia. There was full of them, a whole list of them. There must have been about 30 of them spoke, and it went on for hours, the Russia thing. And then it came to Yemen and they just put up one speaker. They just did the first round. There wasn't a single other speaker from that party about Yemen. Yeah.
So
unreal.
They're more interested in an opposition guy in Russia who happens to be an Islamophobia right winger, and they're obsessed with they want the world turned upside down because this guy has been put in prison, and there's millions starving in Yemen. Hundreds of thousands have been killed. Over 100,000 children have died from the war, which the Europeans have supported from day one, which started in March 2015. I mean, but they wanted, they want only want to talk about Navalny. And just on the business side of it, one of the things that they called for all the time was, oh, Germany must break off its gas links with Russia. The Nord Stream 2 must stop. Now, where did the pressure from Nord Stream 2 come from? That came from the Americans, who insisted back in 2017, Trump was threatening to put tariffs on all cars and all manufactured goods coming from Europe to America. And they begged them not to do it, right? And he said, right, okay, I want you to build liquid natural gas plants and take our...
Dock the whole western coast with these terminals.
Take our LNG, our liquid natural gas, which comes from fracking, the filthiest way of getting fossil fuel out of the ground that we've ever come up with, and transporting that across the ocean and bringing it to plants in Europe. And the competitor is Russia, right? Now, as you can understand, again, the Germans are not going to stop Nord Stream 2. Yeah. And it was interesting, on the political side of it, it was interesting to hear the Russians, listen, lads, we're content from now on. We'll deal with the member states, right? Because, and that really just means Germany and France to them, right? Mm. We'll deal with the member states individually, and you can say what it's like in the European Union. That's what the Russians said.
That's exactly the approach, really, from Russia right now. Mm-hmm. And they are dealing bilaterally.
Blame them? Yeah. Who could blame them when they're being treated like that and abused and caricatured all the time? Like, you know, there was this one getting up, calling them, describing them as a bear, and how do you tame a bear and all this type of nonsense, you know? They really are pathetic.
The same one, she was calling the bear, beer. And I was saying, what's she on about beer? What's this about a beer? The beer. She means bear.
Do you have a blue card of the week, which would be the worst speech that you heard this week? Do you have one?
Oh, Jesus.
Can you pick one?
I don't know.
Was there anyone that was particularly so bad? I think there is a few. We're going to talk about von der Leyen later.
You'll pick yours, have you? Yeah.
No, but let's go on to Yemen, because that was obviously the big priority for the week and it's still a big foreign affairs issue. Tell us about the resolution there, Mick. You've talked a lot on the podcast about what's happening there. We bring it up all the time. But this week we actually were voting on something and it was just voted today. So tell us about the procedure and...
Yeah, look, as we have mentioned in the last couple of episodes, that we've been in here 19 months and we've been 19 months trying to get a debate in the plenary on Yemen. But there was opposition to it all along. And Yemen, by the UN's own definition, has been the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet for a couple of years now, where, as I said, millions are starving and hundreds of thousands have been killed. And the place is a basket case. And it all started with the fact that over the last 10 years, 12 years, there was a huge push by Western powers, mostly the Americans, UK, France, and other Europeans, to bring about neoliberalism in Yemen to facilitate Western business interests. And they had a guy called Saleh, he was president, and he was their puppet. But he got run out of the place because the people didn't like what he was trying to do. Mm. He was trying to force them to grow different crops, not ones that would feed themselves, but ones that would be suitable for export for the Western world to buy. And they were really playing havoc with the way the people in Yemen lived their normal lives. So they opposed this push for neoliberalism. Saleh got pushed out, so there was a bit of a crisis. And then in 2012, Obama and the Saudis decided to put Hadi up as the president.
They
claimed there was a president. He had been vice president to Saleh, and they claimed that there was an electoral process, but Hadi was the only one that was allowed to stand in the election. So, surprise, surprise, Hadi came out as president. But Hadi then tried to implement the same measures and he got run out of the place. Mm. So in 2014, a coalition of six different groups called Ansar Allah, of which the Houthis are one, got together and they started to fight back and said, we want to keep our country and we don't want you guys to take it. So they more or less took control over a huge portion of the country, an area where the majority of the people lived in northern Yemen, and to a point where the Saudis and the UAE said, we got to stop this. And themselves, the Saudis and UAE, and sadly with the help of the UN, sat down with Obama and they'd done a deal. And Obama and the UN allowed the Saudis to start a bombing campaign with the UAE. It was the Saudi-led coalition, it was called. And the UK and France were huge supporters of it. Not just in selling them arms, but in training mercenaries and fixing machinery on the ground, helping them to refuel. I mean, they set about a genocide in Yemen. They targeted food production, they targeted hospitals, they targeted water treatment plants, water supply, cholera units. It was genocide. And the Europeans were part of it. We ended up having six European countries selling arms to them, not just UK and France. We had Spain, we had Belgium, we had Sweden, we had Germany and Italy, right? All selling arms to the Saudis and UAE to destroy Yemen. So one of the reasons that we couldn't get Yemen debated in the parliament was because all these European countries were complicit in a genocide in Yemen and they didn't want to talk about it. They wanted, we had had, as we mentioned before, we had five debates on China since we came in here, and not one protester has been killed by police in Hong Kong yet. Not one. And there was, the place went into a frenzy for 6 months here about Belarus. Five protesters have been killed in 5 months in Belarus. Five, right?
They've actually, as we were saying, they've forgotten about it now.
There's more children being killed every day in Yemen, right? And the only reason the Belarus is of significance to them is because it's on the Russian border and it undermines Russian security. But look at, believe it or not, I actually think there's been a lot of campaigns across Europe to have Yemen addressed. And we have brought the subject into the public domain more. There is a huge pressure on now for all of them to stop what's happening. Now, do I think that they're going to stop trying to plunder Yemen? I don't. But do I think that they'll manage to stop the war? I actually do.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of being made of Biden's statements, where Biden had came out with a bit of a nuanced statement, but nonetheless saying he wasn't going to continue to provide arms to Saudis for offensive measures and so on, signalling a bit of a turn there. Clearly an acknowledgement of the fact that the war, they probably know, is unwinnable on their terms, going about it the way it is at the moment. But at the same time, I suppose it comes back to the point Mick was making about how Yemen was a trade-off, that in return for, I suppose, not bombing Syria, they were able to go into, and they did the job on Yemen, and that the change in tack on Yemen might be at Syria's expense, and that that region of the world is still going to be the subject of huge interference. But I think Mick is right in that it was interesting in the plenary. A lot of people brought up the fact that Europe was involved in selling arms. I mean, what a joke. Like, they're getting up in election and saying, oh God, this is desperate. We need to give humanitarian aid. Yeah, well, you just stop, you know, stop the war is the biggest humanitarian gesture you can make, and all the European countries blatantly breaking the law on it, and they don't bat an eyelid.
We actually have an EU law that says that it's illegal to sell arms to a country that is using those same arms and abusing human rights in the process, right? And they just, the member states ignored the law. Mm. But going back to Claire's point about what was driving, why did they allow the Saudis and the UAE to bomb the living daylights and try and bomb Yemen back into the Stone Age? Another significant factor was that Obama promised the Saudis a trade-off for doing the JCPOA with Iran, which really upset the Saudis. Mm. And this was part of the trade-off. It was March 2015 when this bombing campaign started, and it was just Obama had just done his deal with the Iranians on the JCPOA. Mm. What a trade-off. The millions of people in Yemen for a deal that happened to be upsetting the Saudis. It would remind you of the time when Madeleine Albright, the American Secretary of State, in 1998, she was asked, Secretary of State, 500,000 children have died in Iraq since you put your sanctions in place and the war in 1991 and the sanctions that followed. 500,000 children have died from the after effects of the bombing and the sanctions. Is that, was that a price worth paying 500,000 children just for you to control the price of oil? Yeah, I know it seems terrible, she says, but yeah, it's a price worth paying. Now, God help me. Mm. And to think that Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and Labour at home have, and the Greens have allowed the US to continue to use our airport in Shannon to commit atrocities right across this region and destroy the lives of millions. Mm. And our four main parties at home tolerate it?
No, I think, I mean, it's worthwhile mentioning Obama because obviously Biden was his second in command and fully involved in this process, if you like, you know. So while there's a certain realignment taking place now after Trump, it doesn't mean there's going to be peace in those areas. It may mean that the emphasis of the conflict will move to from one area to another. Somebody will get a bit of easing of pressure and another country is going to be more in the loop, as it were. So I think it needs to be carefully watched. There's obviously a lot of talk about, you know, America's back, diplomacy's back, and the EU seem to be sucking that up, like saying, oh, that's great, that means, but that doesn't mean an end to war. Should the amount of wars under the Democrats were just as bad. Yeah. They just and may be in slightly different places, but still the same.
Diplomacy is back, except with Russia.
This resolution...
And China.
This resolution was just voted. I was just checking the votes there. So it passed by 638 votes in favour, 12 against and 44 abstentions, which is a huge majority. It's rare to see a majority that big. And this is one of the first times, actually, I think, that you've signed up to one of these joint resolutions. So usually each political group does their own resolution and they work to negotiate during the week and come up with a joint resolution. But you signed up to the joint resolution and voted in favour. And the parliament condemns in the strongest terms the ongoing violence in Yemen in this resolution. It says there can be no military solution to the conflict and the crisis can only be resolved sustainably through an inclusive Yemeni-led and Yemeni-owned negotiations process. So does this seem like a breakthrough then? Is this a big change?
I think it is significant. And I mean, we put a lot of work into the resolution and it was really good. And I do think, I honestly think we've made progress on Yemen, and I do think that it will lead to a better position than we've had.
Yeah. It was striking that practically nobody during the debate pandered to the usual narrative of Iranian-backed Houthis and sort of using it as a stick. It wasn't that. Everybody was clear this is a Saudi-led offensive. They were clear that European arms were involved and it had to stop. Yeah. And that is definitely a change for sure, you know.
Do you know how many speakers, I mean, they were obviously there from the start to the finish of it, how many speakers mentioned Iran?
I know, you were saying two.
Two.
Burrell and the Greens
were the only ones to even bring Iran into it.
Yeah, I wonder how many of them mentioned Sweden or Belgium or their arms. Well, anyway, that's a resolution they're adopted. The important thing is to make sure it's not just a one-off resolution and happy off, and that's the
Parliament. Yeah, and I mean, we, you know, without being negative about it, I mean, they say that they want the Afghani peace process to be Afghani-owned and Afghani-led, and look at the state of that. Yeah. I mean, people being killed there every week in the assassinations, going a rotten, corrupt government supported by the EU. With the Taliban carrying on the other side, it's just total mayhem, like, you know. So we have to be careful from that point of view, too.
So need to see what happens next and make sure it's not just a statement, a nice, happy press statement, you know. Another foreign affairs stuff. We don't have a load of time, but we'll talk also about Ukraine and Ethiopia. There were two other things that were discussed.
Yeah, look, just to briefly touch on Ukraine, it was a debate on the association agreement. There was a report on the association agreement for 2021, and obviously our job is to highlight the fact that Ukraine is a basket case at the moment, and I use my time to actually point out the fact that most of the initiative coming from the EU in Ukraine for the last couple of years has been, obviously it's anti-Russian, but they're literally trying to, they're trying to buy up the land cheap. They're trying to deregulate the place. They're trying to change the laws so that state-owned land will become will be sold off. It's actually, it's like a land grab. That's what's going on in Ukraine. Now, the US admitted organizing a coup in Ukraine in 2014. It wasn't a people-led coup. It was an American-orchestrated coup. And it was all, obviously, to undermine Russia's position on the border. And there's been mayhem there since. And we've even seen the vaccine come into play there, where the Ukrainians, the Ukraine government wouldn't take the vaccine from the Russians, wouldn't take it off them. They're sacrificing the public health of their own citizens rather than take it off them. And the only there's certain regional autonomy in Ukraine and the Donbass, which is very much a Russian support. They'd be very much orientated towards the Russians there, and it's actually dominated by Russian people anyway, but it's part of Ukraine. They're taking the vaccine. So, and but the vaccine was offered by the Russians to all of them, but the Ukraine government wouldn't take it off the Russians. Donbass are getting it, and they're all getting vaccinated. I mean, you couldn't make it up. But Ukraine is in a very bad place. It is rampant corruption. It was before the US and the EU moved in, and it's every bit as bad still. And they have a big problem with it. And living standards are dropping into place. And the people are just leaving the place. It's a, I don't know where it's going to end up, but it's a horror scene at the moment, a horror scene. And unfortunately, the EU is up to its oxers in it now, but it's all about facilitating business interests from Europe. Very sad.
And what about then in Ethiopia as well? This is another request.
Yeah, and what happened there? Look, what's going on in Ethiopia is an absolute scandal, and there's over 4 million, according to the UN now, over 4 million people of a population of 6 million in need of assistance in the Ukraine. Or sorry, in Tigray in northern Ethiopia, and up to now, humanitarian aid hasn't been allowed in. The media haven't been allowed in. It's like a form of genocide. It's incredible. Abiy Ahmed, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, who was given the Nobel Peace Prize for doing a deal with Eritrea's president, Afwerki, 18 months ago, 2 years ago. But in actual fact, it looks now as if the deal involved, because Tigray is actually caught between Eritrea and the rest of Ethiopia, because it's right at the north of it, and it's right along Eritrea's border. So we now have, despite the fact that Ethiopia denies it, we have 150,000 Eritrean troops in Tigray. We have the Ethiopian army in Tigray, supposedly fighting the TPLF, the People's Liberation Front, the Tigray Liberation Front. But in actual fact, the ones suffering are the people of Tigray. And it is horrific what's going on. I mean, if something doesn't happen, and the West, and I had, speaking about the Russians, right, I had 3 minutes on this, the debate this evening on Ethiopia. And I kicked the Russians around the place too, because the Russians only last week, on the 3rd of February, were over and they signed a deal with Abiy Ahmed for on a trade deal, right? And the Russians, the Americans, the Saudis and the UAE in particular are all looking to plunder Ethiopia. Ethiopia is absolutely rich in resources, and most of it unexploited yet, and they all want a piece of the pie. So you could even see the Russians and the Americans probably getting on fine in the place, as long as the two of them, as long as the corporations and big business from both sides are doing well out of it. It is just terrible. But the EU were staying quiet, doing nothing about it, because their allies, the US, Saudi and UAE, were up to their nuts in it. And I mean, so they were staying quiet. If we're not careful, we're going to see a famine. We're going to see hundreds of thousands die. That's what's, honestly, this is really dangerous. This guy now is out of control and there's nobody reining him in. And the EU has some potential. They've been too quiet. They have frozen, they've suspended some aid that they give him, but they've really only been slapping him on the wrist. Yeah. It is terrible.
So what should they do now, though?
The EU has the potential to work in unison, and they should really up the ante. Abiy Ahmed has to unconditionally stop the fighting, because he's the one doing the fighting. The Eritrean army have got to get out of the place. It's completely against international law as well. We have Abiy Ahmed committing war crimes. The Eritrean president and the Ethiopian president should both be brought before the International Criminal Court. They should. But, I mean, right now, in the immediate now, the international community has the potential to actually stop the war, but it's got to exercise its muscle in doing so. I'm not asking them to invade the place, but I'm asking them to exercise their influence, which they can. Mm. They can stop it. Only they've stayed silent for 3 months now.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Mm.
And it's dreadful. I mean, even things we were saying, like even, you know, you were saying about the soldiers losing their jobs, Tigray soldiers. We know all the cabin crew and staff in Ethiopian Airlines who were Tigray were all sacked as well. Just vicious violations and discrimination, like an illegality going on, and yet they're quietly turning a blind eye. Just not on.
And Claire, you were talking about another Claire in the plenary this week as well. You fit her into a speech. Tell us a bit about that.
Claire Grady. Yeah, we were really lucky on Sunday night. We had the privilege of taking part in a really moving webinar. It was great, really. From America. It's gas. People always, you know, they used to love us in the Irish Parliament, having gone saying, oh, you're really anti-American. You know, the Americans are our friends. And we're not anti-American. Irish people have a great relationship with America, but we're fully on the side of the American people and speaking out against war and the waste of resources that could be used to feed the American people and deal with their health service and all the rest of it is actually being pro-American, I would say. But anyway, people like Claire Grady and that agree with that. Claire is a 62-year-old activist. She'd been in prison many times before, of Irish origin, obviously, with a name like that. But she was part of the Plowshares movement, where they basically in 2018 had a non-violent action where they, a bit like us in Shannon, but they broke into Trident in Georgia. And seven of them, and they were tried at various stages. Claire's the second last one to start her sentence. She got a 2.5-year sentence in jail for that. She's been in jail before. She's, you know, in bad health, really, because and not happy about going into jail in COVID times. But their determination and their sense of sacrifice of their group is just so inspiring. Like, these people are brilliant. And, you know, to make that ultimate sacrifice of going to prison, there was letters read out from her co-defendants, some of whom are in prison already, 72 years of age and more. And they are as upbeat and positive. And that's the good side. That's how change comes about. And that's what will keep you going in here. You come into this den and you listen to all these eejits mouthing off with them on the Russophobia stuff, and you compare that to the dignity and compassion and internationalism of just ordinary, decent Americans as gathered in the webinar to see Claire off. They had a kind of a festival of hope. It's available on YouTube. I think it's broadcast online or on the Plowshares website. And should really tune into that, because it was inspiring stuff, all the different work being done against anti-militarism, anti-nuclear, and that's the way forward. That's how these things will change ultimately.
Yeah. And well, we're nearly through our week in the plenary. There's just two more things. There's the Circular Economy Action Plan, which was voted. You were working on that, Mick. It's been a few months of negotiations. It's done and dusted now. It was a good result and it passed with a good majority as well. Do you want to tell us a bit about what was happening this week with that?
Yeah, well, just in short, I just first say that Adrian in my office done an absolute Trojan amount of work on this, and Damien himself was working on it, obviously, from GUI's end. And it's a huge body of work. And because we didn't get everything we wanted, but I would argue that, that Jan, the rapporteur, I thought he'd done pretty well. He's Dutch. He's in the Renew group. He'd be fairly right-wing, but I think we've made progress with it, right? Look, the circular economy, it's about moving away from a linear economy where you make something, you use it, and you throw it away, and you buy something new. And it's really about cutting down on waste more than anything else. And like, for example, it's looking to challenge landfill. But reducing landfill isn't going to be good enough if you just go and incinerate it all, right? We've got to actually reduce what needs to go into it. But I suppose the angle that we were coming from more than anything else was the degrowth angle, because really, if we're serious about a circular economy, we've got to produce less and we've got to consume less. And that's the secret. And people might think, well, you know, well, the economy will collapse if we don't keep growing. Mm. And the nature of capitalism, the essence of capitalism, is that you have to keep growing. Capitalism is like a wheel going up the hill. And they see it that if it stops, it'll roll back down. Mm. But capitalism is in trouble. And we are not going to deal with the environmental challenges if we continue to allow capitalism to be the doctrine that dictates how we run our countries, how we run our lives. It isn't workable. And in my short speech, I did mention the fact that in terms of what should we do now, well, for starters, and I was asked at a conference that I was involved in as well about it, someone was asking from an educational point of view, how would we go about changing the mindset so that we can work towards a situation where we actually have real degrowth? And I said, well, the first thing you should do is get Jason Hickel's book, Less is More, and give it to every student in every country, in every school, right across Europe, because it would make a difference.
Because it's only just gone back into print, luckily. It's been in print for ages.
Jason Hickel is one of the more well-known proponents of degrowth, and he puts it so simply, and it's exactly where we have to go. But there'll be pressure, big business, they have the lobbyists, and just as I made the point that we lost out with CAP, we had an awful lot of good work on CAP as well, but when it came to the vote, even in the Parliament, the right wing took over, the lobbyists took over, the big agri lobbyists won the day, and with the new CAP, we will still have 80% of the money going to the 20% richest farmers who don't need it, instead of giving it to the farmers that need it to help them to move away from harmful chemicals, fertilisers and pesticides. I'd be more optimistic with the circular economy. I think it's just different, it's broader, and I just think that the CAP was easier for them to capture. Mm. But I've been making the point lately, and I think you couldn't make the point enough. There's pandemonium around the pandemic, the COVID and the vaccine, the whole lot. But it is so directly linked. Pandemics now are so directly linked to the loss of biodiversity. And we just had an opportunity to address that in the CAP, and all the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil MEPs in Ireland voted for not doing anything about the loss of biodiversity in the agricultural CAP. It was shameful.
Yeah, and speaking about the CAP, we'll be voting again not too long away, perhaps just before the summer, on the final agreements made in the CAP. So after the negotiations with the council and everything, and there's no way that it's gotten any better through a series of negotiations with the council. So I guess there'll be another opportunity for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil to redeem themselves. I'm not very optimistic though. But we'll finish off. I know it's a bit of a long one today, but we can't help but talk about vaccines today. There was a week, of course, with lots happening in vaccines. We had Ursula von der Leyen come to speak to our group, the left, and she also had a four-hour debate in the plenary. Now, the two of you didn't get to speak, but you tuned in and you can tell us what you think.
Yeah, I mean, we were obviously part of the public call for her to address our group, and certainly for her to come in and publicly put on the record account for the Commission's action or lack of action with regard to the vaccines. But that said, we kind of knew it wasn't going to be a big revelation or anything. I didn't expect really any answers, and we certainly didn't get any. I mean, what we got at both meetings, both in the group and the plenary, was really an account to justify what the Commission had done. So in terms of Article 16, she said, "Oh, I'm very sorry, it was wrong and I apologise," and that's it. You know, you didn't even go into, well, what are you apologising for? Who did it? Who was accountable? How did a set of circumstances come about that somebody, a civil servant or yourself, Ursula, or one of your team, thought that it was a clever thing to do to trigger Article 16 and basically provoke a border in with huge implications for Ireland? So, you know, on the one hand, it's easy to say, oh, yeah, we're sorry. And when she was asked at our group, in fairness, Luke put it to her, Luke Wood, saying, how much did Mairead McGuinness know about this? Who took the decision? And what did you know? Are you responsible? And he said to her, and her answer was just pathetic. It was kind of like, oh, we're a collegial body. Yeah. We all operate together. We're all responsible. And I, as the head, am the most responsible, meaning basically I'm not responsible and I'm not going to tell you what went on or take any responsibility. And then with the vaccine, look at people have, it was very well covered in Ireland. People will have heard the nonsense for them justifying it. Oh, we had to come together. I wasn't going to leave any countries behind. No one was arguing for that. She should have dealt with, you know, we wanted solidarity. She didn't deal with, oh, where's the solidarity in countries going off doing their own deals? She didn't deal with the fact that on a global sense, the EU has been blocking the moves to lift the intellectual property right patents on this to allow the production of generic vaccines, which is absolutely necessary for the people in the global south and for the rest of us, because if we don't deal with this globally, we're all screwed. She didn't really deal with the issues of the Sputnik vaccine and other vaccines, just saying, oh, well, it's up to the Russians and the Chinese to come to the European Medicines Agencies if they want to sell their vaccines here, as if like it's a kind of a commercial outlet for them, rather than the EU sort of saying, listen, there are vaccines out there around the world. Let's talk to them all in the way in which we do to the big pharma. Let's talk to them all and encourage them to go before the EMA. So look, it's a bit of a mess, but...
And that story could develop in the next week because the Russians said that they did apply and they've actually published an acknowledgement letter on the 28th or 29th of January. So just what happened?
Went missing.
It's too early to jump to conclusions, but it's a bit worrying. But on the issue of solidarity, I think it should be noted that one of the first things after the absolute nonsense with the 16, Article 16 protocol, one of the first things to come out was the fact that in actual fact, out of the 27 commissioners, there was only four or five knew anything about it. And that in actual fact, von der Leyen seems to be running a little clique and is not engaging all the commissioners in the decision making. What's that story?
Yeah,
wouldn't blame her to say to someone, mind you, like, which we made those points before, you wouldn't really put them out now on your team.
In fairness now, she needs to be taking some good advice from someone, because she's not up to much herself. Thanks be to God we didn't vote for her.
Absolutely. And you know, but I mean, the point is,
The vaccines debacle is anyway, it's continuing, it's non-stop. We've been calling for a committee and inquiry on this as well, so we'll see how that goes with that request. But stay tuned, we'll see what happens next week, and I'm sure we'll have an interesting update. Shinoel.
Auf Wiedersehen. Good luck.